From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Comedy Week continues with three greats. Gary Shandling and Steve Martin tell us how they developed their early stand-up acts, and Richard Pryor talks about living outside the spotlight with multiple sclerosis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Demonstrators in New York City are marching against police brutality. Several thousand protesters are marching on City Hall to condemn the attack on Haitian immigrant Abner Louima. He was allegedly sodomized and beaten by New York City police officers. Louima remains hospitalized with severe internal injuries. Doctors operated on him last night to repair a bowel obstruction related to the attack. They say Louima is feeling much better today. A senior British official will visit Montserrat this weekend to try to smooth relations between the United Kingdom and the Caribbean colony. Residents are angry over the British response to its volcano crisis. NPR's David Barron reports from Montserrat.
2 years after the Soufriere Hills volcano began erupting, leaving much of Montserrat uninhabitable, Britain began a voluntary evacuation last week. The government provides evacuees with a plane ticket to the UK or elsewhere and up to $4,000 relocation money. Many Montserratians have lost their homes and belongings and say they need more aid. Britain's Secretary of State for International Development, Claire Short, last week accused the islanders of demanding too much and angered them when she said they'd want golden elephants next. This weekend, Short will send an undersecretary to mend relations. He'll discuss with Montserrat's leaders the evacuation package and aid for building new homes and infrastructure on the island's northern third, which scientists deem safe. David Barron, NPR News, Montserrat.
In Algeria, hundreds of people have been massacred in isolated farms and villages south of the capital, Algiers. The killings are said to be the most widespread since political violence began in the country 5 years ago. That was after the military canceled elections to prevent an Islamist party from winning. The BBC's Heba Salah has more.
The massacre in Sidi Moussa, just south of the capital, brings to around 1,500 the number of people killed in the last 3 months. Some were killed in bomb attacks against public places, but most died in the same way as the latest victims in Sidi Moussa. They had their throats cut by groups of armed men who invaded their villages at night. So far, it's not clear exactly how many people died in the Sidi Moussa massacre, but a journalist who visited the scene says he saw a large pile of bodies covered by blankets and awaiting removal in a field. Local residents are quoted as saying that the killers were wearing hoods and armed with knives and axes, and that they arrived aboard trucks and cars.
The BBC's Heba Salah reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 27 points at 7,667. Trading is light. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 6.5 points at 1588. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed in light pre-holiday trading. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
On one hand, computer-related shares are rebounding from yesterday's weakness. Compact Computer was rated short-term buy at Soundview Financial, and 3Com Corp was reiterated outperform at Lehman Brothers. But this strength is being met with the negative effects of rising long-term interest rates, which are higher following some stronger-than-expected economic news. New home sales unexpectedly rose for the third consecutive month during July, while manufacturing in the Midwest was surprisingly strong in August. Shares in both Barnett Banks, which is Florida's largest bank, and Nations Bank have been halted. The companies say they may have a potential merger announcement later today. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says Americans spent more last month. Consumer spending increased 0.8% in July. That's the largest gain in 6 months. At the same time, the Commerce Department reports personal income rose 0.1%. That's the smallest increase since October. Analysts suggest more consumers used credit cards to make purchases or dipped into their savings. Consumer spending makes up 2/3 of the nation's economic activity. The home improvement chain, Hechinger's, is coming off such a bad quarter that the company has agreed to accept a 20% lower offer from the California investor that's agreed to buy the firm. Hechinger's downgraded its price after recording a $40 million loss in the latest quarter. The leveraged buyout firm Leonard Green and Partners plans to combine Hechinger's and Builder Square to create a home improvement chain. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Live on tape from Hollywood, The Larry Sanders Show. Tonight, join Larry and his guests, John Stamos, Helen Reddy and the National Spelling Bee Champion, and me, hey now, Hank Kingsley. And now, because he's already been paid, so we might as well use him, Larry Sanders!
It's Comedy Week on Fresh Air, and we open today's program with Gary Shandling. His HBO series, The Larry Sanders Show, is a parody of late-night talk shows. It's up for 16 Emmys this year. That's more nominations than any comedy series ever received. Gary Shandling is the show's star and co-writer. He parodies talk show hosts so well because he used to be the real thing, Johnny Carson's regular substitute host. Back in 1992, Gary Shandling was supposed to join us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. But shortly before his expected arrival time, Gary's publicist called to say Gary had car troubles and couldn't get to the studio. So we did the interview from his home phone. Okay, so you can imagine what went through my mind when I found out that your car wouldn't start. In your talk show experiences, have you ever had that happen where someone doesn't show up and they say their car isn't working?
No, it is the flimsiest excuse, isn't it? It would be better to say my dog ate the car, I mean, or something. It sounds like one of those horrible high school excuses.
So what kind of car do you drive that's giving you this trouble?
The worst story than that, what it is exactly, is my girlfriend bought a Range Rover, and I said to her, well, you know, a Range Rover in California, you know, it's a four-wheel drive vehicle, you know, and, you know, I guess she figures, you know, in case it starts raining, she can't get to that audition in time or something, you know. So it's a four-wheel drive. For me, it's a slightly affected car, although they're very nice cars, and it's hilarious because she bought it yesterday and it's brand new, and then she was going to drop me off at the studio and the car wouldn't start. So not only have I missed this opportunity to go directly to the studio, but simultaneously she's been on the phone screaming at the car dealer saying, well, you know, Gary Shandling missed an interview, which of course meant far less to them than she'd hoped.
So listen, this talk show, you've done the talk show for real, you know, guest hosting on The Tonight Show, and now you're doing a parody of it. What's the difference, do you think, between Larry Sanders as a late-night host and Gary Shandling?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I actually think that on the talk show part itself, on the Larry Sanders Show talk show part that we see live on the air, that is basically me hosting a talk show. That is how I would host a talk show. Larry is very different than Gary as a person, and what we see backstage is not exactly me. Larry is much more driven career-wise, much more competitive career-wise, much more concerned about ratings than I am, much angrier than I am. On the air, he is very similar to what I would be like hosting a show. I find myself, since it's a satire of talk shows, doing a few Johnny moves that I wouldn't probably do if it was really me, and doing a few kind of Letterman moves that I wouldn't do.
On some of the episodes, there's a lot of tension between what's happening off camera and what's happening on camera. I mean, there's one in which you're fighting with your wife
you know, kind of backstage, and then you have to keep running back on the air and being really affable. Has anything like that ever happened to you in yours in the time that you really hosted?
That particular thing has never happened. I have been in a relationship where right before I went on stage, and this is what I took the moment from. It was many years ago, and I was getting ready to go on stage at the Comedy Store, and my girlfriend at the time said, you know, I really want to discuss our relationship. And I said, well, okay, but I'm on in 2 minutes. Well, she said, there's never a good time to talk to you, is there? And we were really having an argument right before I went on stage. And then that kind of thing never stopped. This is not a joke, I was hit by a car about 6 months after that, and I was in the hospital with all these tubes connected to me, and she came to the hospital, and I was on the critical list, and she said, I really want to talk to you about our relationship. And I was like on Demerol at the time, and I said, well, you know, if I don't think this is the right time, but anyway, it sounds like I probably was very shut down and not communicative, but I was, and she just picked the wrong time. So we took that element and made a show out of it.
Boy, I hope she wasn't thinking that you would do anything to get out of talking about the relationship. You'd do stand-up, you'd get into a car accident, anything to avoid that discussion.
I never thought of it that way, but I guess when I joined the astronaut program...
The first TV show you worked on was Sanford and Son.
Yes.
It must have been strange to be a white guy from Tucson writing a black sitcom.
You know, they were all white writers, and I just did a little luncheon with Keenan Ivory Wayans, who, of course, created In Living Color, and we were sitting next to each other, and he didn't know that I had written for Sanford and Son, and he couldn't stop laughing. He literally couldn't stop laughing for 5 minutes when I said, you know, I started on Sanford and Son, and just looked right at him. And he said, my God, you know, things have really changed, because it was primarily white writers that wrote that show. And, of course, now everybody is aware that we should be looking, meaning the industry, looking for new minority writers. And there are so many talented guys out there that should have been writing that.
So, did you write for Three's Company, too?
You know, I had a script assignment for Three's Company, and that's actually when I decided, that was right in the time when I was deciding, I just can't do this.
Well, talk about formulas.
It was when, in fact, really a voice deep down inside of me said, what are you doing? And it was very much like the engineering school when I just said, what are you doing? It was the same kind of feeling, and it was the same formulas over and over again, and I just said, I can't do this. And that's when I stopped and started to do stand-up.
Now, I think that the auto accident that you referred to earlier also had something to do with you deciding to change directions.
Well, there was a chain of events that happened. I was, you know, it was right around the time of, I'd finished my Welcome Back, Kotter, and I was doing a script for Three's Company, and I also had a pilot I was writing, and I was unhappy creatively, and then I got hit by a car, which we don't need the details of, but I was hit by a car and really seriously hurt, and as I was laying in the hospital, I really did realize, I had one of those realizations, like, you know, what do you really want to do in your life is what you should look at, and then try for that. And the only thing that I knew that I wanted to do was develop comedically. I've never had a goal other than when I was hosting The Tonight Show, which really was a goal of mine. But I never had a career goal. It was more an inside creative goal to learn to use my funniness and to discover what my level of ability was. And that's what I went after when I went on stage. It was really a self-discovery process.
So when you were lying there in the hospital, mm-hmm. fighting for your life, were you...
Funny? Was I funny?
Well, seriously, since you were thinking so much about comedy, were you already trying to transform this into, like, your next routine?
Yeah, I did. I wrote several routines in the hospital.
You really did?
I wrote my first time on The Tonight Show, my first stand-up piece was a piece about being in the hospital and hearing that woman in the hospital paging doctors all day long going, Dr. Juergens, Dr. Mark Juergens, over that hospital intercom, Dr. McAvoy, Dr. John McAvoy. And I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I heard that hospital intercom 24 hours a day for 2 weeks, and I realized this woman could say anything, and no one would know the difference. She could go, Dr. Pudding, Dr. Chocolate Pudding, and someone would show up.
When you started doing stand-up, did you have a sense of who you wanted to be on stage? You know, like what aspects of your own personality you really wanted to bring out for your stage persona?
It was really a nightmare. I had no idea who I was when I started, and I was frightened to death and had no natural performing skills. I'd never performed before in my life, and to be thrown onto the stand-up stage is an experience that you cannot fathom until you're actually there, because there's no place to go, and everyone's looking at you, and you can't even see them because of the lights. And yet you have to manage to start talking and be funny on top of it. And at the beginning, I think I did. I wrote material that was very much influenced by Woody Allen, who's my favorite. And I used to do very offbeat jokes that sounded like I was reading them. And it took years to develop a style. And actually, what happened is I was involved in a relationship, and the girl left me, and I was very hurt, and I had to go up on stage, and I finally just turned to the audience and said, this girl left me. I said, what happened is she moved in with another guy. So I dumped her, because that's where I draw the line. and so that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of, you know, people of the Gary Shandling dating years in stand-up that came out, you know, because I realized, I started to really spill my guts about being hurt, and people really related to it. And it just was one of those things. It was in a nightclub in Dallas. I really remember it very well.
Can you give me a sense of what you were doing before you started doing the more personal stuff?
They were awful jokes like... you know, I had a high school principal who, actually this is true, I had a high school principal who committed suicide by hanging himself in the rings in the gymnasium. And it was the next day that my physical education coach found him hanging there in the rings, and he gave him a 9.8.
Oh, God.
And it was stuff like that. That really was not connected to, you know. Actually, that really all happened, of course, other than the 9.8, but every part of that story is true. I said I had a real stupid, I said my coach was really stupid. He had a big sundial in his front yard, and he pulled his back out trying to wind it. It was that kind of stuff that barely worked at all.
It seems to me one of the problems of becoming a celebrity is that celebrities start to take themselves really seriously and think of themselves as being just, like, terribly important.
Yeah.
And that to maintain the kind of humor that you're doing now on your shows, like, you know, the It's Gary Shandling show and the Larry Sanders show, you have to be a little bit detached from all of that in order to kind of see the humor of people taking themselves too seriously and to stand outside a little bit, both from celebrity land and from TV and movie land, and look into it. Do you worry about that being a bit of a problem of ever getting too far inside?
You know, I think that's really a great perception. I think you're 100% accurate, and and that's smart. And you recognize something that a lot of performers don't recognize, and they do start to take themselves too seriously. The truth is that I don't, and in fact, often need to work on giving myself a little more self-importance, you know, because I still think of myself as the guy from Tucson. And what that allows me to do is look around at my friends, and I just cannot name them here, but I know the ones that I, and their friends and acquaintances, that often turn my stomach because they think they're great. and they think that they're important, and they have this aura of self-importance that has nothing to do with being a human being. And they become affected, and I'm able to see that clearly, and that's why I wanted to do this show, is to you know, expose that and show how fake it is in terms of our real, you know, real life existence. I wish I could name names, but I just have friends who do movies and big movies, and my God, they have attitudes.
Yeah, one can only conclude that...
It irritates me. If I sound irritated about it, I it's something that really pushes one of my buttons. It's something that I really dislike.
Okay, so on the one hand, you could kind of, there's the risk of getting too big and really getting carried away by that. On the other hand, do you also live in fear of, like, being washed up and doing infomercials for hair replacement or something?
Well, what's wrong with that? I'm doing one next week. What's the problem with that? Hi, this is Gary Shandling. Have you seen this new product? You spray it on your forehead, it makes it look like your hair comes down to your eyebrows. I'm telling you, I never looked younger.
Well, good luck with the series. I really enjoy it. And I'll let you get back to your car trouble.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get this car started and then, you know, probably sell it.
Thanks.
So if anybody's out there listening wants a 92 Range Rover at a really good price, let
right.
me know.
Thanks a lot for your time. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Gary Shandling, recorded in 1992. His HBO series, The Larry Sanders Show, is up for 16 Emmys. The winners will be announced in September. Coming up, more about late-night comedy. This is Fresh Air. The Larry Sanders Show parodies The Tonight Show, which Shandling used to guest host. It's every young comic's ambition to get a shot on The Tonight Show, and lots of successful comics have great stories about the first time they did their act on the show. Here's a first-time story from the show's current host, Jay Leno.
Well, I got heckled my first shot, which was a horrible experience, but luckily I'd worked a lot of clubs, so I could deal with that, and Johnny seemed to like that. But our producer, who is still with NBC and The Tonight Show to this day, Fred DeCordova, you know, he would say to you, okay, here's the deal. He would come over and he would say, and Fred was somewhat of a legendary figure, having, you know, directed Jack Benny and all these people. He would say, after you do your stand-up routine, if I go like this, waving my hands towards me, that means come over and sit down to Johnny. If I put my hand up like this, stay on your mark. If I wave you away, go behind the curtain. But whatever you do, don't move until you get my signal. I said, yes, sir. I walk out, I do my routine, and thank you, good night, big laughs, Hannah, thank you very much. I look over, and I see Fred about to signal me, and his phone rings. And I see him, hello? Now he's talking, and I don't know what to do. And the audience is now getting into that, you know, down to that odd one or two claps. And I'm still standing there, so the applause picks up a little bit more, as if people are going, oh, all right, just get lost, will you, you know. And I'm going, hi, and he's talking away, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Now the applause is all but stopped. Fred puts the phone down. He looks over, completely forgetting. Oh, come here. Come on. Oh, thank you. You know, I realize it was only maybe 6-7 seconds. But, of course, to me, I might as well have been out there an hour and a half at this point, just hanging, waiting to get Fred's signal to come over and sit down next to Johnny. So that was pretty scary.
On your first shot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, mm-hmm. did he laugh at your jokes?
Yeah, he was very good, actually. He was a terrific audience. I mean, that's what The Tonight Show is. It's not trying to get the audience to laugh. It's trying to get Johnny to laugh.
Right.
But, you know, the
right.
audience gets the cue from the host.
Right.
And if Johnny is laughing, they're enjoying it more.
Did Johnny Carson give you advice about your stand-up act or later on about guest hosting or hosting when you took over?
Not so much about hosting, but he did about, you know, the first time I did The Tonight Show. Well, actually, I was a guy that was sort of the last of my graduating class to do The Tonight Show. By graduating class, I mean all the guys I sort of started with, Robin Williams and, well, not Robin, I mean Letterman and guys like George Miller and so many of the comics, they all did it before me. And, you know, Johnny came in one night at the Improv to see me. Harvey Korman brought him in. And, you know, there are two kind of comedians. There are comedians that have a lot of attitude and not many jokes. There are comedians that have a lot of jokes but not much stage persona. By attitude, I mean those kind of comics can get on stage and go, "Hey, pal, nice hat. All right, what did you win? Like, somebody guess your weight?" You know, that kind of thing. And they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just funny in their nature, but there are no jokes. And then there are other comedians like, you take a guy like Stephen Wright, who are just natural joke writers. You know, very monotone. They tell the joke a certain way. And to me, the best comedians are the ones that combine both those elements. You have a joke and you have an attitude. I remember Johnny came to see me and he said, you know, he thought I was funny, but I wasn't ready for the show because my jokes were too far apart. You know, I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I listened. And then I started watching his monologue, and I realized, you know, he was doing 15 or 20 jokes in a space where I was doing 5. I mean, I could get on stage and being sort of physically big and loud and imposing, I could get a laugh where there wasn't any. But that really, that was great for a nightclub, but not for TV. You know, the idea being on television, if the joke doesn't work, your funny attitude will carry you through. And if your funny attitude doesn't carry you through, your joke will carry you through. And if they both work, you got a killer joke, you know?
Jay Leno recorded last year. The fantasy of someday getting your big break on The Tonight Show is pretty potent. Perhaps nothing captured that better than Martin Scorsese's 1983 film The King of Comedy, about a comic wannabe who's a real loser.
So would you please give your warmest greetings to the newest king of comedy, Rupert Pupkin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me introduce myself. My name is Rupert Pupkin. I was born in Clifton, New Jersey, which was not at that time a federal offense. Is there anyone here from Clifton? Oh, good, we can all relax now. Now, I'd like to begin by saying that my parents were too poor to afford me a childhood in Clifton. But the fact is, you know, that no one is allowed to be really too poor in Clifton, because once you fall below a certain level, they exile you to Passaic. But you know, my parents did put the first two down payments on my childhood, don't get me wrong. But they did also return me to the hospital as defective. But like everyone else, I grew up in large part thanks to my mother. If she were only here today, I'd say, "Hey, Mom, what are you doing here? You've been dead for 9 years.
Robert De Niro as Rupert Pupkin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Steve Martin tells us about developing his early stand-up act, and Richard Pryor talks about life outside the spotlight.
To see the boy king. How'd you get so funky? Did you do the monkey?
Born in Arizona, moved to Babylonia.
Now if I'd known they'd line up just to see him, I'd take all my money and bought me a museum. Buried with a donkey.
Rock for the mind. a crocodile. He gave his life for tourism. Golden Idol.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We continue Comedy Week with Steve Martin. He became a national star through his frequent appearances on Saturday Night Live, and that led to his film career, including starring roles in The Jerk, Roxanne, Pennies from Heaven, All of Me, Parenthood, and Father of the Bride. Here's an excerpt of his act from the late 70s, as recorded on his album A Wild and Crazy Guy.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here for the closing night show here at what is this? Is this San Francisco? Okay, been here for 2 weeks, and this is the closing night. We do two shows tonight, and I'm really looking forward to it. So, so let's get going, huh? I mean, I think there's nothing better for a person to come out and do the same thing over and over for 2 weeks. And this is what I enjoy, so I'm just going to do the same thing over and over and over, and I think rather than do it just twice, I think I'm going to do it over and over. I'm going to do the same joke over and over in the same show. This will be like a new thing. Looking for a little different kind of thing tonight, so then this would be good. Okay. Hey, I'm not trying to be a big shot or anything like that, but I get my drinks half price. That's right, for every one you buy, I get two. So I can just have about as much as I want, you know what I mean? And it doesn't affect me.
I spoke with Steve Martin last year about his early stand-up act. He had been a philosophy major in college before switching to theater in his fourth year, the year he dropped out. I asked if he could think of any part of his act that was influenced by philosophy books he read.
Not really, but I did understand that that you know absurdism came into my act quite a bit, so I think that somehow that was linked to philosophy because it was always denying the truth or making leaps to things that weren't logical or you know it's hard to remember all these things, and if I did, it wouldn't be that interesting, you know, to say, well, yes, this was based on Aristotle's, you know.
That's right.
Because they're not. They're just based on trying to make people laugh, and that's what came out.
But I am into the intellectual thing. I went to college. I studied the great philosophers, Socrates. I studied Plato, and you know, you learn the important things. Like, if you're studying geology, which is all facts, as soon as you get out of school, you forget it all, you know? Because it's just numbers and things. But philosophy, you remember just enough to screw you up for the rest of your life. Then you study the important, like, ethical questions. Is it okay to yell movie in a crowded firehouse? Religious questions. Does the Pope shit in the woods? And keep waiting sometime, you know. Oh. If there is a God, give me a sign. See, I told you that the...
So many comics approach their comedy from an ethnic perspective. There's a long history of, you know, the Jewish comic or, you know, the Jewish dialect comic or, you know, African-American comics talking about coming of age as an African-American in predominantly white America and so on. Did you ever wish that you had, like, an ethnic slant that you could use in your comedy? Or were you not ever interested in heading in that direction?
No, not at all. My comedy was much more mental, and I didn't... It was strange because it was physical and mental at the same time. It was almost conceptual sometimes. So that wouldn't have done me any good. And that comedy exists in the real world, and my comedy didn't.
That's interesting. What do you mean by that, about it not existing in the real world?
Well, it doesn't. I always thought of my comedy character, such as it was, as a person who was totally isolated and who had to, in a sense, redefine the world in order to get by, had to, couldn't be influenced by the outside. He had to deeply believe in every dumb thought that he had. So that's the most sophisticated it's ever gotten. I mean, just saying it to you now, because I never thought about it that much, but kind of looking back. So it wasn't about a person in this world. It was strange. It was about a nutcase in this world.
I think it was after the Smothers Brothers when you were doing stand-up and you were better known at this point. You did a lot for opening for rock groups?
Yeah.
In concert arenas, was it? Was it
that? Oh, I did all that. It was terrifying because, I mean, Albert Brooks has a great bit where he says he opened for Ritchie Valens once and he was backstage and he hears the audience going, Ritchie, Ritchie, Ritchie. And he starts to go on to open the show and there's a guy backstage who is going to open the curtain. He looks at Albert and says, "You better be Ritchie."
So they weren't
exactly
necessarily happy to see you.
No. But I learned quickly that you don't do that.
You don't do what?
You don't open for big rock bands with a small comedy act.
So where did you go?
I went to small clubs. And I places that seated 99 people. And I called David Brenner, who was very hot at the time. And I said, "David, how do you make any money in this world? I mean, I'd get paid, you know, $300 a night, and it would cost me $450 to get there and back." And he said he would lease out a club, and he would take the money at the door. And so I said, "Well, that's what I'll do." So I started going to little clubs and headlining rather than opening, because I understood the audience, no matter how good you did as an opener, they didn't care. They only cared about the headliner. So I decided to play to smaller houses and be a headliner than open the show for larger houses.
Well, anyway, I guess you can tell that I'm into language, and language is kind of my thing, being a comedian. And if you don't have a command of the language, nothing to be embarrassed about, but because this is my profession. And let's face it, some people have a way with words, other people... not have way, I guess.
Did you ever think that you were going to outgrow some of your comedy, that it would be unseemly after a certain age to do some of the physical comedy that you were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's an agreement between yourself and the audience that you are funny. And you know, that you can get very, very hot, and then that agreement can go away. It can move on. It moves on to other places. You know, right now Jim Carrey's got it, and he is actually really, really funny. But when that magic agreement is kind of severed through time, and you say, okay, well, now what are you going to do next? You have to actually be funny. You know, you have to really, really work. And, And you have to find it some other way than just the newness and excitement of it.
I'm wondering, in your work as a writer and a performer, what you think the mix is of inhibition and exhibitionism, if you know what I mean? A lot of performers strike me as being a very interesting mix of inhibition and exhibitionism, of really wanting to show off, and of, on the other hand, being really shy and very uncomfortable around other people.
Well, I think that entertaining is the excuse to open up. So I feel myself very shy. I mean, when I started out, very shy around people. But as you get comfortable with your friends, you really open up, and that's where comedy comes from, is, you know, going crazy with your friends and then trying to put it on stage. And... But there, I know what you mean. There is a kind of quietness that comes, and then you, and maybe because of that quietness, you're compelled to go on stage and let something out, and try to be liked, you know.
Steve Martin recorded last year. Coming up, Richard Pryor. This is Fresh Air. Our final interview today is with one of the most influential comics of his generation, Richard Pryor. He started his career by imitating Bill Cosby, but he later said he knew his days of pretending to be as slick and colorless as Cosby were numbered. There was a world of junkies and winos, pool hustlers and prostitutes, friends and family screaming inside his head, trying to be heard. His comedy was filled with his perceptions about being black in America, and he was able to take his personal tragedies like his heart attack and transform them into comedy. Here's an excerpt from a 1978 performance.
Anybody here ever had a heart attack? No, motherfucker never admit they had a heart attack, right, people?
No, sir, I never did. I had indigestion one time.
I don't care what nobody tell your ass, boy. I was walking in the yard and some say,
don't breathe no more. I said, huh? I said, don't breathe no motherfucking more. You heard me. Okay, I won't breathe, I won't breathe, I won't breathe.
And I tried to ease a little air inside of my mouth. And I said, save, did I tell you not to breathe?
You told me not to breathe, you told me not to breathe.
Well, where are you going? Why are you walking? Stand still.
Okay, I'll stand still.
Get your ass down.
Okay, I'm down, I'm down, I'm down. Don't hurt me, don't hurt me, don't hurt me.
Shut the fuck up. You thinking about dying, now?
Yeah, yeah.
Why didn't you think about that when you was eating that pork, motherfucker?
Richard Pryor's performing career was virtually ended by multiple sclerosis, which was first diagnosed in 1986. I spoke with him in 1995. He was at the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I asked him how much movement he has.
Well, I walked in here today, and I must say the guy helped me, too, walk up to this chair. But really, I didn't bring my wheelchair in today.
So you can walk?
Yeah, now. This lady, I think her name is Marie. She's my therapist.
Mm-hmm.
She comes 3 times a week.
What's the therapy like?
Oh, man. Some days, it's like, I don't feel good, you know? And so I don't want to do it. But she says, well, you have to do it. So 3 times a week, that's what I'm put up with.
Was it like moving arms and legs and things like that?
Man, there was a time I couldn't move any of them. I was in bed like that for a while. I couldn't move.
What did you do to pass the time while you were in bed and couldn't move?
Good question. I'm trying to think, what did I do? Oh, I remember I smoked some bass. No, I did.
Did you really, or are you?
No, I'm serious. And my ex-wife, Flynn, came to visit me. And she walked through my stuff. And she found it. And she said, what is this? I had a rock, you know. She said, what's this? And I didn't tell her because I was scared. And she said, is this dope? I said, nah. I said, just looks like it, but that's not really. And she threw it out.
So have you stopped?
Yes.
Was there a turning point that got you to stop?
Yes. Well, it's called being broke.
Now, let me ask you an odd question. I mean, about freebasing. It's bad for your health, right? But, I mean, your health isn't good anyway, so... Would it being bad for your health not be likely to inspire you to stop? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You're making sense, is what you're saying. And if I was that type of person that made sense, I wouldn't be where I am. Because I never made no sense. You know, it was like, life to me was like, not supposed to make sense. Because, hey, it's, I don't care how you slice it, you ain't getting out alive. So enjoy as much as you can.
You know, it's funny. I mean, some of the things you did were really self-destructive. The free bracing, the setting yourself on fire.
That was a definite.
Definitely self-destructive, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you know, and it's the kind of behavior that you're warned is going, you know, to really kill you. And you survived all of that. And now you have a disease, MS, that has absolutely nothing, as far as I know, to deal with, you know, quote, bad behavior. Do you know what I'm saying? So it just seems like such an irony that all the things people warned you would really hurt you.
It was the MS.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with you getting MS.
No. It's just like God said, oh, really? Okay, here, boom. So try that on.
Well, do you think it's God punishing you for things you've done? Is that what you're saying?
No. Uh-huh. God don't work like that.
Yeah, so I mean, you could have lived this absolutely exemplary life and still gotten MS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a blessing, though.
Getting MS?
Yeah.
How so?
Because it pushes me forward. I'm going through the therapy, and I'm understanding some things about life I never understood.
Anything you'd care to talk about, or is that too personal to discuss?
There's nothing so personal as when you can't walk the way you want to, and then you have to depend on others to help you. And I go, oh, my God. And that's what it is. It's depending on people. And you have to learn to trust them, which is very hard for me. Very hard. But here I am.
You are so important to so many people. I mean, so many people have, like, looked up to you for so long. Do you feel that you have to try to handle your illness now as, like, a role model? Do you know what I mean? Like, when you're a public person like yourself and people are looking at you, do you feel like, yeah, that you need to do it like a role model? Not that you've been a traditional role model to anybody in the past.
It's like...
not that you've taught us to behave in socially accepted ways in the past.
Yeah. Hey, God gave me this, and I'm going to say this truthfully. God gave me just a little bit of it, you know? He said, so slow down for a minute. Take a break. You know, take a break and look at things differently. So I do. Rich is not a bad person. And this disease is just a disease. And I have it. So that's what I deal with.
So what gives you the most pleasure now? What do you enjoy doing the most or enjoy listening to the most?
I like listening to the Gypsy Kings and some Miles Davis, some Marvin Gaye, and sometimes Mozart.
Do you ever listen to your own records or watch your own films?
No, but I have them. I have them. No, I don't listen to them. I keep trying to get a friend of mine to listen to this Lenny Bruce record I have. And Lenny Bruce, oh, it was something he did on his album. God, I can't think of it. Come on, Richard. That's what happens. Your brain goes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it washes away everything you were thinking about. And people stop paying attention to you. You know, you go, I had it.
I know you keep a gun next to your bed.
Yeah.
What for?
Because the boogeyman might come in some night.
Who are you expecting?
The boogeyman. I mean, come on. There's such terrible things going on in the world. People are crazy. They're serious about whatever craziness it is. And I don't want to be caught in no trap and not be able to get off one shot.
I mean, excuse me for asking this, but would you be able to even use the gun if you had cause to?
No. I think the hard thing I'd do is having to cock it. Because it's a 9mm. And the bolt is real hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, wait a minute, please. Just a minute.
Right, help me out here.
Yeah, I'll be with you in a minute. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Richard Pryor, recorded in 1995. Here's an excerpt of Richard Pryor live on the Sunset Strip, talking about his trip to Africa.
So I went to the motherland. It was so beautiful. Just seeing black people in charge of everything. I'm talking about from the wino to the president. It was black. Blue black. Original black. The kind of black where you go, black. And it's great to walk down the street in Africa because every black person in Africa reminded me of somebody here. They did, man. I'd watch it. That motherfucker look like Joe Frazier. I say, damn. Right, and he'd be the president of the bank, and you go, that mother Joe Frazier. If Joe Frazier could see this motherfucker, he wouldn't come out of retirement. And you see winos that I knew here, I see them in, they be diplomats and shit. Right, you go, Willie the Wino! That's what he's supposed to be!
Richard Pryor. Coming up, a comic who influenced just about everyone who came after him. This is Fresh Air. After a week of interviews with comics, we close today's show by paying tribute to Lenny Bruce. Who knows what comedy would have been like without him? Here's Lenny Bruce from a 1959 performance.
Oh, let me tell you about the Steve Allen show. First, Steve Allen, I want to tell you about him. Of all the comedians that I've ever met, he is the most literate. Second, he's the most moral comic I ever met. Guy is very conscious of societal problems and interested in them, and not only talks about it, but does things about it. So he's a good man, a good person, without being saccharine and old showbiz. I really dig him for that. I did the show twice. I was a little bugged with the show because of continuity, of censors. If I do a show, if I work for an hour here, out of the hour, I'll do maybe... Although I create everything myself and everything I tell you and make you laugh that I've created on the stage, of the hour, I will ad-lib 4 minutes tops. Sometimes very fertile, about 10 minutes, but that's a good night. Usually about 4 minutes, top, free form. But for me ever to have to come out and open with the same word every night and finish with the same word and do the same bits in each show in order, then I don't feel like a comic at all. And you got to do this on television, and it's a bug for me. They sat me down there, and they all sat there, 15 guys, and I'm doing the bits. Steve Allen's got a very hip sense of humor, and he cracks up at everything I'm doing. Producer Bill Harback is hip, but he's got a little more to lose. So he gives these kind of laughs like, ha, 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 ha,
Gee, look. Now I went into a bit they didn't let me do on the Allen Show. I have a tattoo. It's really, it's not a cockamamie or anything. It doesn't rub off. Because of this tattoo, I never can be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's the Orthodox scene. You have to go out of the world the way you came in. No marks, no changes, which certainly disobeys the rabbi philosophy. I don't know where that swings. I got back from Malta, so I'm over at my aunt's house in Jamaica, Long Island. I'm in the kitchen, I'm washing with a Roki soap. She pins the tattoo. So she looks and she flips. It's a real Jewish seagull, you know. Look at you then. You ruined your arm. You can't be better than a Jewish cemetery. I said, Mima, what are you nudging me? They'll cut this off. They'll bury this in a Gentile cemetery. Like, all right? Okay. Now, the guy says to me, you can't do that joke. Why not? He says, well, it's definitely offensive to the Jewish people. I says, and you're out of your nut, man. He says, no, that's it. And son, any time we get any satires, any ethnic groups, there's a lot of mail and you can't do the joke. I said, well, screw it. I'm not going to do the show, man. That's it. So there he goes, ha, 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 ha. That's the first defense with me all the time, Mike. Ha, ha, ha. He's a nut, right? Oh, no, don't be a baby. Be a man. Sell out. I don't make any bones about the fact that sometimes I'm irreverent and sometimes I allow myself, this is a rationalization, the same poetic license as Tennessee Williams or Shakespeare. If I want to, if it's, in other words, I'll never use four-letter words for shock value, for laugh, but if it fits the character, then I want to swing with it and say it. Naturally, I know I can't do this on television, but here I'm not making any scatological references. I'm just doing a true kind of bit. So now, I'm really getting hot with a guy. You're not going to do the joke, and yes, and don't tell us, and blah, blah. Well, listen, we'll talk. We'll have a meeting. He says, you can't, don't know meeting. This guy's really putting zingers in. There's one guy, I really hate him. He's got a Bank of America collar there, you know. And he said, he can't, it's offensive to the Jewish people. Now they argue for about an hour. They keep me in the corner. I'm like the leper with a bell on my neck waiting. The guy comes back, he says, we talked it all over, Lenny. You know, it's definitely offensive to the Gentile people, too. Oh, yeah? How do you figure that? He says, well, what you're saying in essence is that the Gentiles don't care what they bury.
Lenny Bruce, recorded in 1959. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Laura Womack edited many of our Comedy Week interviews. Alan Tude directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Have a great holiday weekend.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we extend Comedy Week into Labor Day and talk with Albert Brooks about his life as a stand-up comic and filmmaker. His latest film, Mother, is out on video. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.